with the sofa. Phone bill about 2G's flat. No need to worry, my accountant handles that. And my whole crew.
Notorious B.I.G. Juicy. This is his birthday. I don't know whether it's Commissioner Batch's birthday, but today, Police Commissioner Anthony Batch joins us in the studio. Welcome, Commissioner. Good to have you here.
Thank you. Can you put Biggie back on?
We can.
I was liking that.
You like that?
Yeah.
Put that back on for
but
the commissioner.
But you got to put a little Tupac, too.
Well, now we're talking. 410-319-8880. A little balance. Write
yes,
us here at steinershow@gmail.com. Go onto our Facebook page or tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. We're going to get to the calls coming in now. Kim and Ernest, you're the first two callers up. We will get to your calls, but let's begin our conversation with Police Commissioner Batts here. And thank you for coming in once again.
Thanks, Mark. It's good to be here. You know, it's funny. I was running into residents who say, I see you on TV and I hear you on the Mark Steiner Show at different times. And they say, you know, we're glad to hear you, but when you come on, can you talk about something positive? Why do you talk about all the hard subjects? So, Mark, that's your job. I'm telling you that's what your customers are saying out there.
They say they want to talk about positive vibes.
That's what they were telling me, so I'm just sharing with you.
I'll ask the questions and you can give me a positive spin. How's that?
Touche.
So let's begin with what's in the headlines at the moment and what people seem to be very concerned about, which is the death of the young man at Good Samaritan Hospital the question of tasers. Young George V. King was 19 years old, was already sedated, they said, was subdued by people at the hospital. Officers came in. He was tased, according to some papers, five times, heavily medicated. And people are demanding to know what happened. It raises a lot of questions about tasing.
I think that's reasonable. I think that people should be asking. I'm asking the same questions. And we're looking at some policy reviews coming off of that. There's some issues that irritate me about the entire situation. What I mean by that is I'm a proponent of tasers. I've seen them used in other organizations that I've been at, and they've reduced force use against residents. They've reduced injuries to residents. They've reduced injuries to police officers, and that was proven empirically researching that. And so I'm a proponent. There are circumstances where you use tasers, and there are circumstances where you don't, or any tactical situation. What I want to know, and I asked my guys to look in it, is, number one, why were we there? What was the reason that we were called as a police department to go to a hospital? I want to know what that was all about. My understanding is that the young man, George Von King, was admitted to that hospital 24 hours prior and had been there for a while. And that when we're called, what was the purpose of them calling us when they were having a problem with their own patient? And what was the law that was broken when they called us? And why did they have five security officers there and then still call the police department? So there's a number of issues. And when my young officer, who had about a year and a half, arrived at the location, what is it that they wanted him to do and what they were expecting? So what I have done as of yesterday is I put a moratorium on us responding to hospitals or mental locations before sergeants evaluate why we're being called into those situations. What is it exactly that you want the police officers to do when you're struggling with a patient that's in a hospital? And my information is that he was not sedated, that they had been struggling with him for a long extended period of time before they called the police department. And when you're having those issues, what is it when we arrive that you want us to do? What is our interaction to be there? So I'm looking at that policy of revamping it, changing it. We're checking our policy on how many times that you have the ability to use any tactic. And part of what I've taught in other agencies is that if a tactic's not working, you have to go to another one. You can't continue to use one. And we're looking and evaluating a policy if that was necessary in that circumstance.
So there are questions at time of life is someone dies as a result of an altercation with police. There are a lot of questions.
Altercation between the hospitals and police department, and because they had five security guards who were addressing it before we got there.
The guy was hit five times with a taser.
He was also probably under medication before we got there. There was a reason why they called us. They had been in conflict with this young man prior to us arriving. So to say that it was just an interaction before police officers, that's not accurate.
No, and I know that your predecessor, Commissioner Bielfeld, when he was on the show, and I think he said it on national TV as well, but on this program, talked about he was uncomfortable with the use of tasers. He didn't like using the police using tasers, and they and only, I think, 300 of the officers in the force had the number right at, under Bielefeld had tasers.
That's a pretty significant number. It's actually interesting because, number one, I won't comment on what Fred thought was right or not, but he outfitted his organization with 300 tasers. What I stand and what I say is that based on empirical data and that we've seen before, is that tasers, if applied correctly and with the proper policies and the proper restrictions, are utilized in a correct way. I think they are more humane to injuries to residents. I mean, there's nothing that we use right now that will not cause injury to a person. There's nothing that we use right now that may not cause death to a person. We have batons. We have the ability to strike people with batons. You can strike a person accidentally and strike them in the head and cause injury to them that may cause their life. You can hit them in their xiphoid, in their chest area, in the wrong place and cause them to lose their life in a battle because people are not standing still. They're always in motion. They're moving. We can do wrist locks on people we twist people's arms and we call them rear wrist locks that cause injuries to tendons, to tears. They could break arms along those lines. We could use mace or pepper spray, depending on that person's medical ability. That can impact them too. There's not a lot of things we have that have been invented right now that may not impact people. And so what we do is train people to use them correctly. We train them to use them in a humane way and in a correct manner.
So one of the things about that, I mean, you tell me if this is wrong or right, that tasers, the guidelines for tasers have not been updated since 2007.
Yes, 2007 is the last time we were going through a process of updating all of our use of force documents, not only for tasers, but any use of force as a whole. So we're revamping. Part of the strategic plan is revamping all our policies dealing with any type of force.
Because right now it says you should not use them excessively.
Yes, and what does excessively mean? Exactly,
is
and
it
I
five
agree.
Hits? Is it two
Correct.
Hits? Is it?
You're absolutely right, and that's what we're looking at right now and addressing. And that's where my statement was: is that if you're using any tactic, whether it's using a taser, whether it's using a wrist lock, whether it's using a baton, whether it's using whatever it is, and it's not working, then you need to go to another tactic and to address it. You can't continue to use it. Now the question becomes: in that scenario, because I don't have all the information, and I'm not going to make supposition here, and I would kind of caution all of us from making supposition because we really don't know what happened in that scene yet, and that's why we're doing an investigation. Was five necessary? Was four necessary? Was three necessary? And that's the basis of our evaluation. And the bigger issue, like I'm saying, is why were we there? Why were we called? Are we going to be called anytime you have a struggling patient in a hospital? That's a bigger issue that's there.
So you have to design taser training, obviously. That hasn't been designed yet. For the police
no, that's
academy.
Not correct. We design taser. We don't issue tasers without doing training. We do that and have done that on a consistent basis. The training is based off the policy that you mentioned. We evaluate, we test, we grade them using tasers. So that's not we have to invent training. Training is there, and training has been there. Again, my bigger issue is not only just tightening up on the policy and addressing the policy to national standards to make sure that it's correct, but even to my standards where I want it deployed. But also at the same time, as like I was saying, is why are employees put in those positions? And I think that's the bigger issue for us.
So one last thing. So I'm going to go to the phones here. But a quick question here. I mean, it's been 15 months. When was, as a training director, going to get hired? Speaking of tasers and training, when is that director get hired?
Say that one more time.
Has it been 15 months now since the head of the academy has been hired?
No. Yes and no. We had an applicant that we had taken through the process, a very qualified person, PhD, had a lot of experience, but they didn't get through the background process. There were some things that popped up that was concerning to me, so I had them redo it, start all over again. We have a gentleman that we've had in place. He's had to take care of some things with his family, his house and all those different things. He's coming from another state, a very well qualified, very good at what he does, and I believe he lands here probably in the next week or two. But during that time, I've had a guy in position, Captain Mason, who's done an outstanding job. I've been very proud of him. He's done a great job. If he didn't have some of the attributes that this young man I have coming in has, he would have kept him in position because he's been doing an outstanding job within those 15 months.
That's good. So one last thing I do want to open the phones at 410-319-8888 as we talk with Anthony Batts, our city police commissioner. So only a few officers have tasers now. Do you plan to have all officers carrying tasers?
We have pretty close to 600 officers today having tasers. We have purchased about 1,000. We have roughly about 1,900 officers who are in patrol. Any uniform officers, that will be part of their uniform. And so as they go through the academy, part of their equipment that they've been supplied will be a taser.
So have you met with Georgia King, the mother of the young man who was killed? Have you talked to her since his death?
I have not, no.
Do you intend to?
It may be something that we reach out to. I mean, in every case that we have, I may or may not. It depends on the circumstances. And I won't be able to meet with every person who loses a life within this city. I've had the opportunity to meet with some of the young men who've lost their life, their parents who've lost their lives on the streets. And so we'll work that. It may be that she doesn't want to meet with me, and you have to leave it to her. We have to open up those lines of communications. We have to see if that's something that she wants. And if we can make that happen, then we'll see how it works out.
410-319-8888 is the number here. We're talking with Police Commissioner Anthony Batts. A lot of you want to speak with him, and we have a lot of questions here ourselves. As we continue to look at what happened to the young man in foster care who died at Good Sam Hospital. 410-319-8888. Kim, you're on the air.
Taking my call. Good morning, Commissioner.
Morning, Kim.
Good morning, ma'am.
I am a supporter of you, Commissioner, as you know.
Yes, ma'am. I know which Kim this is. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, sir.
That's good to hear you.
Yeah, you also. I want to thank you and the officers who wear the uniform proudly and honorably.
Yes,
and
ma'am.
We know there are some who don't. I have two comments about the curfew law, and I'd like to get your perspective on them. The law really has no discussion about the disposition of our children once they're picked up by your officers. We know that there was an instance a while back where officers picked up two young men and dropped them off in Howard County. I do not believe that this law should be silent on that aspect, and at minimum, it ought to take them home. The second issue that I have is, who will the violations be issued to, the child or the parent? And if it's issued to the child, is it going to be recorded in your criminal record system? And what does that mean in terms of implications for the child?
Okay, that was three very good questions. The first one, those officers about 3 to 4 years ago who did that have been held accountable and strictly held accountable, and I think they've gone through the legal system and also our administrative system, unacceptable and will not be tolerated under my administration. I think that was the previous administration that took place. Secondly, I don't look at curfew as a law enforcement mechanism. How I see it, and I've been very clear on this, there's times that we've been out on streets where I see young kids, and I say young at the age of 10 or 12 years old, out on the street at 1 o'clock in the morning. And there's an issue with that for me. We've had, and I used the term babies, we've had babies out there who have been impacted, been out on the streets where they're not protected, where we have predators who are out there at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. Children should not be out there unsupervised at that point in time. If you have a child who's out on the street at 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. on a Wednesday or Thursday night, that's an indication. That should be an alarm. That should be a bell that's going off to our entire system and our entire community that child is in crisis. And not only that child, that family's in crisis. And most likely, if they're out on the street at that time, they're not going to school, which is the biggest hope that they have for their future. And so what the program is set up to do is to take these children, not to lock them up, but get them to a center, get those parents into that center, and hopefully get those parents into wraparound services. So you start addressing the family, not just the child, but addressing the family, and to get kids stabilized. And so we can look at it as a negative in saying that we're stopping the children out there. But we could also turn it into a positive to make sure that we're getting the right services to families. Now, curfew is the word itself is a misnomer many times to the community because people think that a child cannot be out on the street after that time. The law is built to make sure that kids are not loitering in certain areas. And specifically, what we have an issue with here in the city of Baltimore is kids or groupings loitering in front of liquor stores where we have gun violence that takes place. If a child is at work and leaves work and is on their way home, they will not be cited for a curfew violation. If a child is going from point A to point B, maybe they're home to a party, they're not going to be cited for a curfew violation. And so it doesn't mean that a kid can't be out on the street. It means that if a child is in jeopardy out there, there again, the extreme being 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m. in the morning. I was just out on the street the other night, and they had babies out there at about midnight who were like 5, 6 years old running around and saying, where are the parents? And that's what we're trying to build this, is try to build a mechanism that wraps around that family and saves our children, not impact them or leaves them with a record.
So Kim, thanks for your call as always. So we had the mayor on here the other day, last week, talking about the curfew.
My mayor?
Your mayor.
How'd she do?
She was very passionate.
Okay.
She was very passionate and got into a little titter.
You never tell me that I have passion.
Well, I'll let's finish the conversation. We'll see how it goes.
Well, come on, Mark. You still didn't play Biggie, so go ahead.
He'll give you some more, I'm sure, before the day's over. But there was a real back and forth between the mayor and Councilman Stokes on that particular program. Both passionate in their own right.
Sure. But I think they both want to get to the bottom line, which is protecting our children.
But two things came up about the curfew. Would it be better to have it handled by the police? Or by, let's say, something to do some immediate action, like a force of people who are counselors and social workers, something like Safe Streets, but not Safe Streets, that are out there when they see it. Their job is to go that's the wrong way to put it. Go to the child, go to the parents' home, sit down and say, why is this child out? What's going on in the home? And rather than have the police have another layer of work on the police that also puts the police in a negative interaction with the community on top of that, in exacerbating that, maybe this is the wrong way to go about this.
Yeah, I like how you put descriptors on things, Mark. It's not a negative interaction. I don't know if I disagree. It's that's up to the policymakers and the legislators how they want to craft that. But I think social workers
could be deemed or seen as negative.
Or it could be seen as positive, and it could be a positive thing in saving that child, which is where I want to go and what I'm looking for. But I think there's room for both. The reason the police officers have it is because we're all over the city. We're out on the street. That's what we do. We come in contact. We see people. I think what would be really neat, and there again is up to the legislators, is if the kid's taken into those centers, that's where you need the social workers, and you need the social workers to follow up with the families. Why is this child out? And, you know, as people are dinging us for even wanting to do this, did anybody ask the question, where's the parents of these young people who are out there? They gave birth to these children out there. Why are the parents allowing these children to be out there? Is anybody asking these tough questions? It's easy to take shots at the police department and make us the bad guy in all these scenarios. But somewhere in this city, we have to stop for a second, take a deep breath, and say, why aren't the parents watching their children, being on top of their children? When I was a child, when that sun went down, I had to be in the house. And I was raised by some Southern parents, and I was raised in the hood in South Central L.A. But when that sun went down, I had to be in the house. So why aren't the parents taking the responsibility?
But you said earlier two things. Kim Chuhart called back.
Mark, I think you ignored my statement.
I'm not ignoring it at all.
I'm insulted, Mark. You have too much passion.
I mean, I just lost those chats. If you can put them back up, that'd be great, because something just happened with my computer. It went screwy. But I think we have to go to a break anyway. And it's time for the Ozzie Brothers. Ron Ozzie's birthday was today.
That's what I'm talking about.
For the love of you.
Yeah.
We'll be right back. But we have a couple questions about the curfew to finish that conversation. Go to Ernest. Go to Jackie. We have questions about the new police contract and other issues around police department and the press. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Fats Waller, born on this day in 1904, ain't misbehaving.
I liked it.
That's good.
Yes, reminds me of Pennsylvania Avenue and Billie Holiday.
What you know?
Nothing. my era was 1970, so disco era.
I do like Pennsylvania Avenue. I remember very well as a kid. 410-319-8888 is the number here. But let me just finish this very quickly so we can really jump into the call. Get Ernest on the phone. And Jackie and others were calling in, and we have an email here from Philip, so I'm going to get through all this. But one of the things that you know, the curfew, when you said we're not going to stop kids, just walking back from a party or whatever. But the curfew, A, starts at 9, and it doesn't start at 1 in the morning. So that does call for interaction with kids who may be 16 years old coming back from anywhere they want and being stopped, saying, why are you here? You know, when they could be coming home from a job or anything else they might be doing,
yeah,
A. And B,
yeah.
Kim just wrote back saying, but you didn't answer her question about what happens to the kids? Who gets charged? What happens to the parents?
No, I answered it. And Kim only gets one question at a time. She can't ask four at a time. She's a wonderful person. We have a curfew now. I mean, the reality is this is not anything new. The only thing that's changing in the city of Baltimore are the hours. So we have curfews currently and now. What you see is the vast majority of young people, when a curfew comes, they go home. And that's what we're looking to do. And the reality is that we don't want our kids out and that are in jeopardy, who are young at age, who are 12, 10 years old. And so I don't think that's the worst thing in the world. I don't think that is inhumane and that's a hue and a cry. Parents need to have the responsibility of taking care of the kids, and kids should not be roaming streets of the city of Baltimore at all times and nights. And like I said, this is not anything new for this city. The reality is, during that time, we've had kids when the curfew's been here over the last several years who have gone to parties, who come and go from work, and have not had an issue or a problem. So this has been here. It's not changing, other than the time to make sure that the little ones are in by 9 o'clock or as the sun goes down.
And we have a tweet in from BlueAfricanLotus.com. It says, Bats is on point. I have small kids out on my block at ungodly hours. And the question is always, where are the parents?
Exactly. It's interesting, Mark, in having these conversations, it always goes back to the government or the police department. What's the police department doing? Why is the police department at fault? And we don't even ask the tough questions. Where's the parents and why are these children out here? I have three kids of mine. No, not kids anymore. I have three adult children, grown adults. But my responsibility, we're taking care of those children. The government should not have that responsibility. The parents should have that responsibility. We gave birth to these kids. And that's where when we start pointing fingers at the government and start pointing fingers at ourselves and saying, what do we need to do to wrap around to keep our children safe?
410-319-8888 is the number here, and let me see. We're going to Ernest as I see who else has kind of called in and written in here. Ernest, you're on the air.
Yeah, good morning.
Good morning,
to the commissioner.
Good morning, sir.
I have more than 25 years on the Baltimore Police Department.
Sure.
Now, my first bad impression with the police came when I was about 16 years old. I was leaving St. Edward's Church. A group of us was playing basketball. I'll never forget it. Walking up Poplar Grove Street, I was stopped by white officers. We were stopped by white officers. And he asked us, where were you coming from? I said, St. Edward's. We were playing basketball. He hit me as hard as he could for no reason at all. So I didn't say anything back to him because I knew I'd be a loser. I went home to my and told my grandmother and my parents. I said I was just accosted by a police, slapped in the face for no reason at all. He was from the Western District. And my grandmother and family said, I said, can we go make a complaint? They said, no, nothing's going to be done. So just forget about it. But I never forgot about it. It's always been in my mind. The other thing is...
How old are you now?
Huh?
How old are you now?
I'm 71.
Yes. And you still remember that happened when you were 16?
Yes.
Unacceptable. Unacceptable to treat any human being that way. Unacceptable to put your hands on any person. And from my stance, and I wasn't there here at that time, and I've only been here a little less than 2 years, but what I can tell you is that when complaints are made now, we take care of them. When we have conduct that is out of line, it is addressed, whether I have to terminate people, whether I have to discipline them in other ways, I take that very seriously. And there is no reason why officers should treat people that way. Even in the years that you were talking about, it's unacceptable.
It happens, and it's happening all over the United States, even as we speak. Police go crazy. I just saw on television the other day that I want to get the tasers, where police kicked a 16-year-old boy, handcuffed behind his back, in his head. And they caught it on camera. But let's get to these tasers.
Yeah, because we're already going for about 4 minutes here, and we have a lot of callers, so go ahead, please. Get to the tasers. Ernest?
On the radio, I mean on the computer. And it says tasers causing death and injuries in the United States. It's a lot of incidents, and they, some places call it torture. But all the years that I was on the police department, and I worked in several, we never had tasers. We were always able to lock somebody up. I don't care how big they were, how muscle they were, and we used espantoons. And I never heard anybody in this police department, the Baltimore Police Department, killing somebody with a nightstick. Now, I think it's no need to have tasers. And because you know, when we talked the last time, we were talking about cameras and tasers. You were against cameras. You were for tasers. And I told you, before it's over, somebody's going to be killed by these tasers.
Right. So let me ask you a question. Ernest, so look, are you against cameras?
No. And Ernest is, he calls every time that we're on and we have the same conversation on the multiple different lines. And Ernest has his own opinions. And for me, and what I told him last time, is I think any time that you have a use of force, and there again, he's talking that he was a police officer at some given point in time, and the dichotomy is that he's also talking about being a victim of police brutality in years past. So there's interesting dynamics that he's putting out there. There is no time that I think when you hit the human body with any instrument, if you hit a human body with a flashlight, which is a metal pipe, or hit a human body with a wood stick, call it espantone or anything else, and you hit the body with wood, you're breaking bones. You have the potentiality of hitting someone in the head, and there have been people throughout the United States who have been struck and have succumbed to injuries from batons. I think tasers are one of those instruments that locks up the muscles. And first of all, people have to understand what a taser does. Usually it you fire it, and you're supposed to be within 20 feet of a person unless you have close contact. Two prongs come out. Usually they're lodged in the torso, so officers are taught to shoot in the torso. So the prongs take place, or they're like little fish hooks that end up maybe at the top of the chest and at the bottom of the abdomen. I don't know about you, Mark, but once upon a time I had to put on this electronic belt around my stomach to try to get some abs six packs, and they would cause my abs to clench back and forth to do exercise as I sat on the couch not doing anything. Well, the taser works in the same way, and where those prongs are at the top of the chest, at the bottom of the abdomen, is that all those muscles tense up. And when those muscles tense up, what it causes the person to do is to go to the ground. Once they're on the ground, we handcuff them. And then we have the responsibility to call in paramedics or taking them to the doctor to immediately to check on their heart, to check on their blood pressure, to make sure that they're doing okay. Those prongs are also, they also lodge in the skin if they make those contacts, so you have to remove those. And what's critical to that is that what I'm trying to get across, there is no tool that we use right now that is totally fail-safe. If a person has a heart condition, when you use a taser, can they be impacted in a negative way? Absolutely. If a person is on drugs or medication, could that come into play? Yes, it could. But with the tools that we have in law enforcement right now, where you're not crushing bones, you're not breaking an arm, you're not crushing a sternum, the taser is a good alternative and a humane alternative, I believe, to do policing in a different way.
Let me go to the phones. 410-319-8888. Jacqueline, you're on the air.
Hi, Mark, and hi, Commissioner.
Good morning.
Thank you for the call. Good morning. So in regards to the taser use, I want to ask you, what is being done to prevent positional asphyxiation in regards to people who are medically compromised? If you look at the health disparities in Baltimore City, most people who are engaged by the police have heart trouble, have emotional issues, have drug addiction. And so when a taser is used, and normally in the most and best case scenario, someone is healthy, although in Baltimore City, most people are not who are engaged by the police, we have a situation where we're tasing people who are medically and emotionally compromised. And when you say they are taken down in handcuffs, they're taken down in handcuffs by 5 to 10 officers who put the person face down, their chest is compressed, and they die from that. There are best practices available to your business, your line of expertise, that can prevent deaths and murders and manslaughter by the police due to positional asphyxiation when tasers are involved.
You're very correct.
So I want to find out what is being done on the ground right now to prevent the death, because we lost the life of a 19-year-old homeless foster care youth.
Commissioner?
Thank you for the opportunity to answer the question. And the reality is that that's the training that we are, in fact, doing. Throughout policing for the last decade and a half, it's been pretty clear. And positional asphyxiation is a problem in law enforcement. And what that means to other callers is, like, as she said, is if you're handcuffing people and you're having extended struggles, the ability, at least on the West Coast, what was happening is that officers would handcuff a violent prisoner, and they would also put a rope around their legs and put their legs attached to the handcuff to immobilize them. And what it was found out in the mid-1990s was that fact that they cannot expand their chest and get enough air into their chest. And so what we are training at our police academy to make pretty clear is that you need to put people on their sides so they have the opportunity to breathe. And also anytime that you deploy a taser, our policy says immediately you call, in any deployment of taser, you call the paramedics to make sure that you check them immediately, or you take them to a hospital immediately thereafter after the deployment.
Well, are you confident that's what your officers are doing?
That's what our policy is, and so that's what we follow up and check on. If you want to tie me into, are they all doing that, that's what we train and that's what we follow up on. I think the caller also made a statement that I don't know it's totally accurate when you say most people have heart conditions or most people have a mental illness. I don't know if that's empirical data that has been researched that's shown. Now, we do have homeless, and we have a homeless population out here, and we have drug addicted people who are out here. I think the way that our policy is set up today can be tweaked, and we are looking at tweaking it to make sure it was best practices. But as far as it relates to asphyxiation and positional asphyxiation, we are training properly and making sure the officers understand that.
We have about 19 minutes left here, and I want to make sure we get have a lot of people calling in and writing in. Lou wrote in, Preakness weekend, Baltimore, last Friday, Saturday, 9 shootings in 2 days. That's an average of one person shot every 5 hours. 70 murders in 5.5 months. That's an average of one murder in Baltimore for every 48 hours. Better than last year, but still unforgivable, unforgettable.
Agreed. Can I talk about something a little different, kind of a shift to here, a change? As we're driving the conversation here, I wanted to kind of talk about some of the, when we got off of that curfew issue. One of the things that I'm proud of that we're starting to do is not only do the curfew that the city's doing as a whole, but we're starting, and we want to put out there an explorer camp. And what we call the explorer camp is that at our police academy this summer, and I'm trying to get funding for it right now, we're looking to go to the 9 different districts within the city right now. And we're going to have a camp for kids where we're going to do lacrosse, where we're going to do flag football, where we're going to do, if kids have interest in training for MMA type of things, not to teach them how to fight, but to teach them the discipline and the training that takes place with police officers. I'm looking to my dream and my hope is to impact pretty close to 500 kids this summer, to have a place for them to go midday, 2 to 3 times a day. I have to get the transportation and the buses to get the kids, and I'm trying to get kids in a more problematic areas. And our Explorer program is also kids who are interested in becoming police officers. As a result of me being an Explorer program in South Central Los Angeles, you see the impact that I became a police officer and give back to the community. So I'm very proud as we talk about the things this police department does. We don't get an opportunity to talk about the positive interactions. And as we're trying to bring an organization that has hope to our community. So not only are we talking about integrating with our kids in a positive way and changing the young kids out there, but also changing police officers and our interaction in a very positive manner. So there are very positive things that are going on in this police department. We're doing a tremendous amount of cultural awareness training. Dealing with different cultures, sensitivities to police officers. So we're working with the Department of Justice. We're working with a lot of consultants coming in to basically change the culture. So these things that people are calling in on and they're complaining about the years and decades of how this police organization has interacted, I didn't make this happen. But what I am trying to do is change the culture and correct this and correct the behavior and the expectations of this police department to meet the expectations of our community. So we're doing a lot of positive things out there.
I think Explore programs are great, and I was a fan of the PAL program when it existed here under a former commissioner.
Mm-hmm. And people talk about it all the time, and in officer-friendly programs.
I agree. I'm not going to disagree with that one at all.
I love you, Mark.
410-319-8888. Commander Batch, why would police officers, this is from Philip, in a uniquely unmarked car chase a stolen car at high speed through the city on one of the busiest streets? They could have followed that stolen or on car undetected if they so desired. We are lucky no one was killed yesterday. If five or so occupants were unaware that they were being followed, just let them drive. 9 times out of 10, they'll be stopping the car for one thing or another within 15 or 20 minutes. Is that too long to wait? Those cops were more than likely bored and just needed an adrenaline rush. There was no need to pursue in a reckless manner. You need to investigate and train and retrain. Critical thinking was sorely lacking yesterday.
And there again, on a supposition, it's the comment or the thought process is that those officers did everything wrong, and that any interaction with the officers, they're doing things wrong. When the officers do something wrong, and it's proven, I hold them accountable. But there's many times these officers are doing a good job. On that particular case, that was our stolen auto team, which is called our RAT team. These guys do this on a regular basis, not chase people, but they get stolen cars. What they actually did yesterday, what was reported to me, is that they had this guy driving at high rate of speed. They shut down. The officers were not chasing them. What they did is they called in the helicopter, and the helicopter followed this guy. And so no one was pursuing him or causing him to drive fast. This 18-year-old with a 16-year-old passenger in the car felt a need to drive that way. And so the officers were not in a high-speed pursuit of him, as stated there. And this 18-year-old young man felt a need to endanger lives. So we need to put the blame where the blame is. It wasn't the officers chasing him. It was this criminal who felt a need to steal this car and drive at a high rate of speed and put people in jeopardy and to endanger their lives.
410-319-8888. Keisha, you're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning, Mark Steiner.
Good morning, Keisha.
Commissioner Batts.
Ma'am.
I have a question. My question is, I met you on the NAACP building, and I asked you to look into Sergeant Daryl Murphy and Serena Green, and I still never heard anything back from you.
Ma'am, I have Sergeant Sneed, who's on the backstage there. If you we get your phone number, somebody will call you today to follow up on that. And he's waiting for your phone number and your information.
He's right there. I'll pick up the phone. 410-319-8888. Let's go to Tawanda. You're on the air.
I'm on the air. How you doing? Good morning.
Good morning, Tawanda.
Yeah, I was listening to you talk while I'm outside of Glenn Bernstein's office. My family, we're protesting because you already know my brother was brutally murdered. And I hear, Commissioner Betts talking about, the policies and procedures and whatnot, and new taser use and whatnot. The whole community saw this whole army of road cops on my brother. They beat him, they maced him, they tased him numerous times. They had him handcuffed on the ground. On the ground with handcuffs on, and then Officer David Lewis from Morgan State sat on my brother's back while he was taking his last breath. So it's obviously clear none of these officers were following procedures. And I just feel like now y'all really need to let the feds come in and handle this. We waiting on this investigation to go. We still haven't heard anything as far as my brother's case, but it's ongoing and that it's coming. But we need this thing to hurry up. Y'all need to bring the feds in and start prosecuting these murderers. I feel really unsafe knowing serial killers are riding the street at any time can take my family life. We had a police officer recently and saved his life, and this man carries a gun around 24 hours a day, and they putting rats on his car and harassing his family. So imagine my family thing. It's hard for me to sleep. Like, I'm a teacher. I got to go to work. I'm trying to be at work now teaching my class, but I'm here in front of Greg Bernstein's office protesting. Tomorrow is my brother's birthday. My brother's life was cut short.
So what is going on with that, Commissioner Batts? I mean, you said you were instituting an investigation, a civilian investigation.
The Tyrone West family from the incident that occurred back in the summer of 2013. The case had to go through the coroner's office. Then it had to go through the state. Let me get to it. It had to go through the state's attorney's office, which they had rendered their recommendations. what I do in these circumstances where you have really high-profile situations to make sure that we're transparent, that we're open, that we're doing it the correct way and not trying to hide anything is that we brought in a committee of experts. They have been meeting since I believe, late December or early December. What's taken so long is that they're going through the evidence. They're asking questions and multiple questions. They're doing a good job of questioning everything. They're probably about 90% finished with the case. One of the board members had some more questions. I much like I was talking to my staff last night, I told them to tell the board that the family needs to have the answers to these questions. And the board has taken a long time, so we're pushing them very hard. But the questions that they're asking are very germane. The questions that they're asking are very tough questions that they want the answers to. So they're walking through that. They're making sure that it gets done, and hopefully we'll have it out in a short amount of time. Much like I said, I think the family deserves to have the answers to those questions.
So you have a time certain when that's going to be over? Your investigation internally, whether the report will be out?
If it was up to me, it would have been over already. It's the board that's walking through that. You have the experts. And what I don't want to do is shut them down before they have the answers. And then what will come out is they will say that the police department was manipulating this investigation, that we didn't give them an appropriate amount of time, but also encourage them to move quickly so the family would have answers to that. So the board is meeting. These are doctors, professors, medical professionals. These are experts outside of the police department that have come together who have done this before.
So two quick questions. I'm trying to get back to the phones as well. Whenever you come in, the phones are always full, as our email bank is as well. But I was going to ask a question about what is happening between you and Justin Fenton and the Sun. Edward Erickson's article came out, and why Justin Fenton, a colleague of ours, is being kind of stonewalled by the police department.
I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this because there's nothing between me and Justin Fenton. I think I have an excellent rapport with Mark Steiner and all the other reporters. I've been doing this a long time. I've been doing it almost 3.5 decades and working with the media on a regular basis. And I can say, you know, the vast majority of interactions with media, you guys have a tough job. Your responsibility is to shine the light on everything. And my organization and my guys are open and transparent and will continue to be. And we just expect every interaction on both sides to be professional. When they're not professional, then we go to the policymakers and we talk to the policymakers on the opposite side. What I have told my staff is to sit down and fix this thing. I'm not in the middle of it, nor do I come in contact with it. It was written to put me in the middle of it. But what I simply expect is as common courtesy to the staff out there, not to name call on them, not to cause problem with them. So I told the staff to fix this, move on. We have bigger issues to deal with than this.
You know, was it true, though, that was he blocked from coming to a press conference, physically blocked by police officers from coming to a press conference? Is that true or not?
Mark, I don't think he's ever been physical. I see him at meetings on a regular basis. I see him every time I'm out at nighttime. I just saw him last week. He was just standing in front of me about a foot away from me as we were doing an interview. So I don't know what that's all about. It's a lot of hyperbole, I think, and I believe we've sat down with the reporters of the Baltimore Sun. I think Justin George at the Baltimore Sun does an outstanding job. Very pleased with him. You have a young guy named Colin who's over there as a reporter, does an outstanding job. I think the vast majority of all the reporters in the city, they do a wonderful job, and I very much appreciate the tough job that they have.
So, I'm sorry,
I even appreciate you, Mark, and the tough job you have, too, and the tough questions you give me.
So I'm sorry we can't get there. So many people calling in. We're not going to be able to get to all the callers, and nor will we focus on a couple of things we didn't get to was the police contract. And also a question I had about George Kelling, who wrote Broken Windows Policy. Is he still an advisor to the police department here in Baltimore City?
Mr. Kellen came in one time last year to help us with Lexington Market, and it was like touching an icon, a gentleman that I read when I was back in college, and had some very profound ideas where we start working on issues from using social workers, mental health, drug abuse counselors with the police department. And so we're not seen as an occupying army going into an area, but part of a team that's trying to help and to provide hope.
I guess one of the fears people had with him was that if what's going on in Pimlico or, let's say, Lexington Market or wherever, is that we're going to start seeing more people arrested for things like open beer cans and loitering.
People don't understand what Dr. Killing's writings were. Now, there's been some things that have been bastardized from his theories, But if you read his theories don't talk about any of that at all. His theories talk about dealing with the issues as a whole, much like what we did bringing social services, other pieces. Now there's been other organizations that have taken that and have misconstrued it as going out doing a zero tolerance. But Dr. Killian has never said that. You go back and read his writings and his books, and they don't say that at all.
Let's try to get – can we have one more caller in here very quickly? Yes, 410-319-8888. Let's go to Philip. You're on the air.
Philip?
Philip, you're on the air. You have like 3 minutes, so go to it.
My name is Philip. Good afternoon. Good morning, everybody. My question is about my wife. I bought my wife a car, and she had an accident, and it was a lady police officer right driving right behind her. The guy came through a red light and bumped the front of her car. The police officer told her that, "I saw it, I got your back, I saw it, you ain't got nothing to worry about." They didn't write a police report. They asked my wife if she wanted to get a car towed. I said, "How bad?" She called me, I said, "How bad it is, can you drive it home?" She said she could drive it home. I said, "Well, don't let them put the car on a tow car and mess up the bottom. Just drive it home,
okay.
We get it."
Phil, let me ask you just because I think we have like a minute left. This sounds
okay.
Like a
what
question.
What I want to know is they didn't write a police report. Now I got a lawyer, and the lawyer is saying that the other guy's saying that there was two more people in the car, maybe okay. Four people in their car, and said that
I'm sorry to interrupt.
I can't find that police officer.
So that's why I'm asking you to hold on. What we need to do is have you hold on, have one of the sergeants take your number. Right now, and then can we do that?
Absolutely, Sergeant Sneed's back there. We'll take the information. And as we close, Mark, I'd just like to say that we have about 500,000 calls for service a year, every single year, year in, year out, and at 500,000 calls, our force complaints are down in the city as a whole. Our citizen complaints are down in the city as a whole. Our training is up, and we're changing the dynamic of this organization. In our strategic plan, it's clear that our organization is not on target with the expectations of the community. So we're realigning the police organization. There again, we didn't break these pieces, but we're darn well putting things in place to change this organization. And I look forward to the day that when I come on, that the callers call in and share the positive stories that officers are doing.
Well, I'm looking at the notes on the screen now. I'll tell you right now, before we go, that Tim and are calling in and saying he supports Commissioner Ed's calling in to say how hard has your job been as Commissioner. So there are other questions coming in we didn't get to that.
But I didn't hear that from you, Mark. I'm waiting to come from you, Mark.
We'll do that off mic here. Please, Commissioner Bass, great to see you again.
Thank you, sir.
See you next month.
Yes, sir.
Good to have you here. Thank you so much. Thank you all for calling in and writing in. You can send me emails to mark@steinershow.org. If you didn't get through today, I will do my best to answer those emails. If I think they need to, I will send them right to Commissioner Batts' office,
sir.
So he can answer those questions as well. We're going to take a break, come back, talk about what happened with Tell Me More and NPR and why more black programming seems to be in the axe at National Public Radio. And then we'll look at Brown v. Board. Stay with us. We'll be right back.